Thanks for downloading Crossing Continents from the BBC. I'm Tim Hewell. And for this edition, I've been lucky enough to go for work somewhere I've always wanted to go on holiday. Stunningly beautiful, but way, way off the modern tourist track. Though it's where Leon Trotsky, Nikita Khrushchev and other Soviet leaders went for their breaks. Where is it? We're coming up to the border now.
This is completely a surreal scene because it's a normal modern highway, but the only way that we can get along it is in a horse-driven wagon. A load of people in the back of the wagon, you can probably hear, and everybody else on this road is simply walking, lots and lots of people walking from one side to the other.
I'm approaching a border that few people are allowed to cross by car. The border of a mysterious country that, as far as most of the world is concerned, doesn't exist. You won't find it marked as a state on many maps. Its passports are accepted hardly anywhere. And yet, the Republic of Abkhazia has maintained a separate existence on the shores of the Black Sea, south of Russia, for nearly 24 years now. For Crossing Continents, I've come to this remote, little-visited territory to find out what it means to live in an unrecognised state, to see what a small, determined nation gains by attempting to go it alone in the face of world opinion, and what it loses. You can't get to Abkhazia or leave it by plane or ferry. And coming from the south, as I am, few people are even allowed to drive over the border, a restriction that enterprising local horse owners have taken full advantage of to earn a little cash from travellers who can afford it, though many can't.
Women with babies, old people carrying loads of things. Some of them are obviously trading. They're, you know, dragging back Chinese blankets and things like that. About a mile we've got to go before we get to the Abkhaz checkpoint.
And we've arrived.
Abkhazia is a very small but very beautiful place on the coast of the Black Sea, and it's surrounded by beautiful Caucasian mountains located between Russia and Georgia. It has been around for a very long time.
And it's a warrior nation because the country is so beautiful that everybody wants to possess it.
In many ways, we are very fragile because, you know, mostly on our own, we're trying to build institutions and to function as a nation, as a state, as a society. I think we have a sense that we have paid a very heavy price for our independence.
There aren't many places that look more idyllic than the Abkhaz capital, Suhumi, or Suhum as it's known in Abkhaz. The elegant promenade resounds to the intense playing of dominoes and chess. There are men in cloth caps and shirt sleeves slapping down the pieces as their fathers used to before them. The beach is lined with palms, and the old pastel-coloured houses are festooned with scarlet bougainvillea. In Soviet times, Abkhazia was where the Politburo came on holiday. Abkhazia then belonged to Soviet Georgia. But when the USSR began to implode, Georgia did too. The Cafe Amra on the promenade was a favourite of young intellectuals in those days. They sat for hours over coffee, trying to figure out what was happening to their country. Among them, Liana Kvarchelia, who was then head of English at Suhumi University.
The place, you know, it has a symbolic meaning for people who live in Suhum and who were born in Suhum, because it was a very lively, popular place. People of all backgrounds, artists, musicians, young professionals, everybody came there. And that was the place where we could talk about everything, from art to global politics, whatever. And a lot of people became friends for life in that place.
Abkhazia, like much of the Black Sea coastline, was then still a tapestry of different peoples, Russians, Georgians, Greeks, Armenians, as well as ethnic Abkhaz. But Liana and her friends, who loved that tapestry, watched from the Cafe Amra as its threads began to unravel.
It was a little bit above the city, so we were literally sitting in the cafe when people started a row, and then which grew into a really big mess. It was a very tense time in general for our country.
Georgian forces tried to reimpose control. In response, ordinary Abkhaz, teachers, doctors, drivers, took up whatever guns they could find and learnt to fight. They were vastly outnumbered. But after a year of savage battles, they drove the Georgians out. Abkhazia declared itself independent. The price? The war left a total of 8,000 people dead and the Abkhaz capital in ruins. So many fled that today there are only 250,000 people in Abkhazia, half the pre-war total. And all this on, and this seems an obvious thing to say, but this is a resort town. Fighting all around us, fighting on this very promenade. Indeed, you know, we can even see the marks even now in the pavement of bullets and shells. And
it literally, it was the beach and the promenade. That was, people were running, crying, shouting, and when I came here after the war, there was so much destruction.
You still pass some roofless shells of houses in Abkhazia. Now, even 24 years on, there's been no peace treaty. There isn't even much of a peace process. Georgia says that Abkhazia is still part of its territory, and most of the world respects Georgia's position. Only four UN members currently recognise Abkhazia: Russia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and the Pacific island state of Nauru. But that's not for want of trying by this man.
My name is Vyacheslav Chirigba. I'm a trained linguist. I'm Abkhaz, ethnic Abkhaz, from Gagra. I'm an active politician. I was the Abkhaz representative during the war with Georgia. And after that, for many years, till 2007, in the Western Europe, Abkhaz plenipotentiary, yeah? Like diplomat, roving diplomat. We think that only by having our statehood, nationhood, yeah, we can preserve our identity, our culture, our language and our traditions, because we are small people and we want to control our lives, ourselves, our culture, everything, control our present but also our future, not allowing others to control it for us. Every person is unique and also every people is unique, yeah? So Abkhazians also have unique features, like a very peculiar language, which is one of the most difficult languages in the world.
What family is that?
It's North Caucasian linguistic family, close to Circassians, also related to Chechens, Dagestanis, Ingush, and these North Caucasian mountain peoples. Yeah. Abkhaz is famous for its special sounds, its guttural sounds and whistling and sissing and hushing and so on, like tr, ko, ke, ko, sh, zh, and so on. So it's a very peculiar pronunciation, which is very difficult to grasp, actually. And they have only two vowels, A and E. Our alphabet history is as difficult as our historical past, but also unique culture. They have old Christianity, then it was, they're also Muslims here, Islam. But also Abkhazians preserve their, very vividly, their old traditional culture, traditional religion. And many Abkhazians who call themselves either atheists or Muslims or Christians, they all go to the traditional shrines and revere them.
That older set of beliefs is a local form of shamanism in which certain holy places are revered. Priests come from particular families who choose a successor among themselves when one dies.
So we're travelling along a muddy track. There's some
red-brown calves trying to escape, also running along the road in front of us. We just crossed a ford over a very fast-running stream. It's a village full of orchards of fruit trees, flowering acacia trees, drowning in greenery. And we're trying to find the home of Zaur Chizhba, who is one of the seven main priests of the native, the local religion of Abkhazia, or as they call themselves, the guardians, the custodians of the holy places. This is the village of Achandara, which is in the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains. You have to go up a road from the coast, and it's in villages like this traditionally that most Abkhaz lived. So it's really in villages inland like this, halfway up the mountain, that the Abkhaz culture is most preserved. The tangerine trees are just coming into blossom, little white buds opening out, and the fragrance is really beautiful, kind of really sweet fragrance wafting over the garden here. The sound you can hear there is of Zawa wielding his scythe. He's quite a tall, elderly man. He's got a yellow straw hat on and black Wellington boots and a very colourful fleecy waistcoat, actually. And further on, this is amazing, where he's also been working, you can actually see a very, very old-fashioned hand plough. So there are two horses here pulling the plough, and as it turns, you can see big, big clods of earth. It's beautiful, kind of brown, chocolatey colour being turned up, kind of glistening just as the sun's coming out a bit. Behind his house, wreathed in mist, is the mountain Dudripsh. It's a place so holy, Zawa says, that even animals involuntarily turn away from it. During the war against Georgia, Zawa put on his ceremonial robe and tall woolen hat and sacrificed a bull here, a ritual that he repeats every year on the anniversary of victory. So this very mossy tree next to us here, and round it tied up, there are all these sharpened forked sticks with bark stripped away. And when he makes the sacrifices, and he makes the sacrifices just here, then the meat is boiled, and the heart and the liver, he says, are taken out, and the liver is pushed down onto the sharpened stick first, and then the heart above it. And then he's just showing me, I stand here and I look out at the holy place. So basically we're looking now up to the mountain, and the mountain now is completely covered in cloud. And I stand here, I have in one hand the stick with the heart and the liver. In the other hand, I have a candle. God recognizes Abkhazia, Zaur tells me, over a lunch of grilled meat and wine and vodka. So what does it matter? Who else does? But help hasn't just come from heaven. Zaur and his wife Ira tell me how they hosted some of the volunteers from all over the Caucasus Mountains in southern Russia, Chechens and Dagestanis and others, who fought with the Abkhaz in the war. Russia negotiated a ceasefire in 1993, and today Russia is Abkhazia's main protector. On May the 9th this year, as every year, Russian and Abkhaz soldiers marched together along the seafront in Sukhumi. It's the day when the former Soviet Union celebrates the defeat of Nazi Germany. Since 2014, there's been a combined Russian-Abkhaz border force here, allowing Moscow to regain a presence along 200 kilometres of Black Sea coast that it lost after the fall of the Soviet Union. So, has Abkhazia fought off Georgia just to become dependent on another, far larger neighbour?
Russia is useful for us and we are useful for Russia. So it's a symbiosis of interests, so I don't see anything bad in it. People, it's better to be friends and then useful for each other, like in friends or family things. And Russia is a sole provider of financial assistance to Abkhazia. Nobody wants to do it.
But you can see why they want to do it. They end up controlling a piece of prime Black Sea coastline.
You know, for us, so what? So what? For us, it's important to be assisted. And Russia is a friend. He's on the other side of the border. We have good relations with Russia. Why should we not accept this assistance when it is being provided? If the other countries would like to provide our assistance, we will accept it. No problem with it. We have also relations with Turkey, yeah, which is on the other side of the Black Sea.
So you're not a colony in any sense of Russia?
No, not at all, not at all. We don't feel us as a colony. And the Georgians, when the Georgians say that Abkhazia is occupied, you know, they have to prove that it is occupied. There are two rather medium-sized Russian military bases here, which are here on the basis of our agreement with Russia. Not that they came here and put it there. No, it was an agreement signed by both presidents. And it's the same as Kosovo. Look at the situation in Kosovo. It's very symmetrical. There's an American base there, 7,000 servicemen. It's a big base in the Balkans, biggest American base in the Balkans. It's Kosovo occupied by Americans.
The Abkhaz, and many Russians, say that the West is guilty of double standards. It recognised the independence of Kosovo from Serbia, but there's no sign that the West's even considering recognising Abkhazia. It's hardly likely to, while it regards Georgia, which dreams of joining NATO and the EU, as an ally, and Russia as an aggressive opponent.
I think it was a Russian factor, which the Americans and the European Union didn't want to follow the Russian agenda as they saw it, as in recognizing Abkhazia, because it was Russia who initiated the process of recognition. Yeah? They didn't want to support Russia in this. We were, in their eyes, on the wrong side of the barricades.
They saw you as a Russian pawn.
Oh, they saw me as a Russian pawn in the fight against small, democratic, freedom-loving Georgia.
I have, unfortunately, even today, some friends who have never been anywhere outside of Abkhazia. I mean, they go to Russia, Moscow sometimes, but very rarely, but they have never been anywhere outside of the region.
That's Rustam Anchba. He's 24. He doesn't remember the Soviet Union or even the war with Georgia. He's a child of the new Abkhazia. Young people like him may be proud of their Abkhaz passports, but they can't travel far because so few countries recognize them.
When I was a kid, I remember that I was taking it for granted because I believed that, you know, everyone leaves that way, and I thought that that's a normal thing. At that time, I did not feel that much isolation. The more I learned about it, the more I learned about the world around me, that's when I actually started realizing how difficult it is for someone, an ordinary person from Abkhazia, to actually travel, to go somewhere. I mean, the world now, I mean, there are so many difficulties and issues, but at the same time, the world is full of so many opportunities, especially for young people. You can be practically anyone and anywhere today. However, we, Abkhazia and the younger generation of Abkhazia, is not part of that process. It's very difficult for the people in here to explore the world, to even travel. I mean, just go education, going somewhere and studying. And that, I think, is a big, big issue. And for the more time goes like this, the less opportunities. Because we need to look at the situation in Abkhazia and the unresolved conflict, because now the politics are so interlinked, and then the conflict between Abkhazia and Georgia is no longer a conflict of only us two. It's a conflict, there are interests, vested interests of a lot of different actors and players, and it's very, very difficult to find opportunities for discussing, opportunities for moving on and forward when you have situations where people basically speak and live in completely different realities. you know, isolation works in different ways. We've tried so hard to get outside, to be heard and everything, but then when generations leave in this and to survive in it, and then this isolation now is becoming a self-isolation.
When I came here after the war, the Georgians fled. The Greeks were evacuated by the Greek government during the war. The Armenians, a lot of Armenians left for Sochi. A lot of Abkhazians fled also from the part under Georgian control. I think we have a sense that we have paid a very heavy price for our independence. Of course, you can argue about how independent we are, because we're very dependent on the assistance that we're getting from Russia. We are, in many ways, we are very fragile because, you know, mostly on our own we're trying to build institutions and to function as a nation, as a state, as a society. And there are very few opportunities that we can learn from other countries, for instance, because of our isolation.
24 years after the war, Abkhazia is still deeply traumatized by the sheer scale of its suffering and losses.
You can hear the waves here on the seafront, and it's the sun's about to set, so the whole sky looking out over the Black Sea is this amazing pink shading into blue, and very thin little clouds, layers of clouds over the sea, and one fishing boat only. And I'm sitting with Guli Kichba, who's lived here all her life.
Ну я выросла и родилась в Сухуми в 49 году.
I was born in Suhum in 1949, but the best days of my childhood and youth were the 60s, the 70s and the 80s, when life here really hummed and bubbled.
Сухуми. Я здесь мальчишкой бегал босиком. Сухуми. И кажется, хотел стать моряком.
Миллионами заезжали сюда со всех концов и сюда.
Millions of holidaymakers came from everywhere, and boats docked at all the piers bringing Czechs and Poles and many Germans. They brought things to sell. And you could hear people talking in German and other languages. And we children ran after them, and they gave us sweets and chewing gum. And it was such a lovely place then.
Guli grew up to be a teacher. She married and had two sons. In 1992, both went to war. The younger was so badly wounded that he's permanently disabled. The older one never came back. For 21 years, they couldn't even find his body. Eventually, it was identified in a communal grave.
2 years ago, I buried my son for a second time. As a mother, I couldn't stop them going. They all went, friend after friend, brother after brother. Even my mother, who was already old, knitted socks and gloves for the soldiers. And so, when they identified the body, it wasn't by the DNA, but by his clothes. They were the socks my mother knitted.
Everybody went to the front.
Yes. And imagine our first president said we were a small nation, an only child shouldn't go to fight. But think, I had two sons. How could I choose? How could I say, you go and you don't go? I couldn't choose. They were equally precious to me.
О, как мне трудно без тебя, сын мой, мой мальчик, отзовись, любимый.
It's so hard without you, my son. My boy, please hear my cry. You come to me often in my dreams. I long to touch you. And I feel so light and easy then. But waking up is so terrible.
Что очень страшно в этот миг, проснуться.
Today, Guli works to help other mothers of the fallen, but she's persuaded them to take off the traditional black scarves of mourning and wear colourful ones instead.
People are not stuck with the conflict. They're not stuck with all of these negative things that are happening. You see, you know, people laugh, people leave, they plan their lives, they do things, but we all strive for better lives. We all strive for better opportunities. I believe that an independent state of Abkhazia can be, it can and hopefully will happen in the future. I do hope that in my lifetime we will resolve the conflict. I plan on staying here long on this planet, so let's see.
That's a brave hope. As relations between Abkhazia's champion, Russia, and Georgia's champions in the West become ever more poisonous, the chances of the world recognising this tiny state aren't improving. And time, in some ways, only hardens divides. A generation of Abkhazians have now grown up with almost no contact with Georgia, and a generation of Georgians that's had no contact with Abkhazia. They can't even know what they're missing of each other's culture. But Liana Kvarchelia, 20 years older, certainly knows. She does what she can within Abkhazia to keep tolerant attitudes alive in the voluntary organisations she now works with. It's a debt she owes to the friends she had, many now gone, that she sat with for so long at the Cafe Amara.
When we were sitting in that cafe, the feeling was that there was no sense of time, no sense of place there. Just, you know, a place where people, like-minded people often, even people with differing views, were talking about eternal things, something like that.
And when you said we all sat here, friends for life, mm-hmm. So have you been friends for life? Where are they now?
Some of my friends, they're still here in Suhum. Some died in the war. Some emigrated, Australia, New Zealand, whatever. Some of my colleagues, former colleagues, they live now in Georgia. We lost contact with the people of Georgian origin who worked with me, who were my colleagues. So once in a while, you know, we get in touch, and we talk to each other as if we never parted.
That edition of Crossing Continents was presented by me, Tim Hewell. The producer was Monica Whitlock. Next week, I'm a bit further around the coast of the Black Sea, watching a stunning display of Russian naval power. And you can catch up with other programmes from the series by typing Crossing Continents into your search engine. Thanks for listening.